Welcome to the Archive Guys podcast. I'm Matt Patterson, and these are my co-hosts.
Kelsey Milburn.
And the other one is
DW Ferranti.
We have now, Greg, your last name. Maybe I screwed it up.
Matt always pronounces last names wrong, and with your last name, I actually wanted to have you say it first.
Oh, you're the air. It's Airbar.
Airbar. Greg, if you're listening to this, because most of the people who encounter our podcast, it's audio. Greg's last name is Ehrbar, and your Twitter handle is at Greg, what I just spelled.
He is a very active animation historian.
And more, because you
worked, and more, and
worked
more
in the industry for a long time, Greg. I went to your website, and you have two versions of your resume. One, which is like simple. Yeah, you do. And then it's like, if you want to read the details, go down. And it's like all like
six point
type.
Well, I actually started in film production.
Mm-hmm.
Whoops. I was writing there as well as doing various parts, because that was right out of college.
Well, Greg, you just finished writing a book about Hanna-Barbera.
Yes.
Who?
Yes, I did.
We together, you know, with all podcasts and Comic-Con, went deep. We got to meet a lot of the people involved throughout the history of it. But there's number one, always so much more. And number two, as time has gone by, people may now, you know, younger people may have heard Hanna-Barbera, but they may not know exactly who they were and what their importance is and how they changed animation history.
They kind of have fallen into the among all the others. They're just this group of other companies, group of other clusters of characters. And what is not realized is they were at one time the biggest, and they were the pioneers. And there is not anything on television that's animated that doesn't owe what they developed. And it is all traceable back to what they did through trial and error and out of necessity. This book is going to be, because I know music and records and voices and sounds, this is going to be told through the over 200 recordings that were generated by Hanna-Barbera and their artists, starting with the very first record recording that ever was generated by their work, which was The King That Couldn't Dance, that came out of Anchors Away in 1945. And going all the way to the Tom and Jerry movie that came out last year that Christopher Lennox did the score for, which you can get on, you can download, which is a great score. And the stories he told me were like so incredible, and how he worked to get the sound of Scott Bradley, but they couldn't actually use the actual scoring, but how they worked to get the sound of it, and how, you know, there, a lot goes into those things. They're not just slapped together because it's just Tom and Jerry. It's just, you know, it's not the big time. They really wanted to make it good. And he was so thrilled to do this. And I'm not going to tell you everything.
Tom and Jerry, I'm just going to say,
corporate-wise,
are huge. The big time. Are the big time.
Well, yeah, indeedy do.
I know the fans pretty much you're only focused on original Tom and Jerry, but as not to be cynical, but as intellectual property, Tom and Jerry are pretty frickin' important even now to David Zaslav, who probably wants to feed Tom to a shark.
One of the things I want to point out in here is that, well, first of all, they won more Oscars than Meryl Streep. Sorry, but it's true. With all due respect.
Oh, now we're getting into Hanna-Barbera and MGM and Hanna-Barbera's history.
Yes.
Okay.
But, But all right. but I do have some of that in the book. But I also want to point out something about Tom and Jerry also, about the recent stuff where the people are like, it's no good anymore. The stuff that Spike Brandt does and that Tony Cervone do, you know, they're not the old stuff, but take a look at some of that stuff. You know that the Back to Oz score, same songwriters that wrote Dear Evan Hansen and wrote some of the La La Land songs and this new Snow White that's coming out. It's like, it's not like it was a good score. And the animation is not all outsourced. They still had Dale Bear working on the Wonka one, doing the slug work thing. You know, people have this assumption that it's bottom drawer. No, they do as much as they can, as well as they can. And take a real good look at what they did, look at the circumstances around it, and how, when other people had the same circumstances, didn't quite cut it as well as they did, and why.
Because it was a very LA thing where you had voice artists who were also DJs, right? I mean, Casey Kasem, of course, being the most famous. But it wasn't just Casey. There were a lot of people who worked in radio, worked in cartoons, worked in music. Right. Hanna-Barbera might have had limited animation, but its audio was off the scope.
Adults or working adults tend to be a little more dismissive of arts aimed toward kids. If you did not grow up with it, if it's not your nostalgia, sometimes I feel that people can get dismissive. And as an adult, the quality of the writing, the animation, everything is sometimes amazing. Just because it's for kids doesn't mean it is easily dismissed or the quality of the work is less.
Yeah, I totally agree. And we've talked about, you know, Peter Pan records and stuff that's aimed at kids. And it's kind of an art form unto itself. Just because something is made for kids doesn't mean that it, you know, doesn't have the same musicians, the same singers, and the same attention to detail and quality when they're done well. And when Sesame Street was on, I was way too old for it, but I still liked it. And I still bought the records because it's like, and I go back to it and I think, I can't believe how good this stuff is, the quality of these melodies and how sharp the Muppets humor was, how they taught these things so well. No matter how you approach them, whether they're supposed to be teaching you or just entertaining you, you can just admire them for what they are.
Kelsey, your dad exposed you to a lot of things, plus you were watching TV. You know, when I first told you we were going to be talking about Hanna-Barbera, what did Hanna-Barbera mean to you?
Okay, well, so I didn't recognize the name, but obviously once I looked into it, I went, well, I've seen all of this. I've seen Wacky Races. I've seen, did they do all the Looney Tunes as well? Like, they didn't do Roadrunner and those. Did they do those?
That was Warner Brothers. So
okay, tell me the distinction here. Actually, because I don't know if everybody will know it just off the top of their head. Can we name a lot of the cartoons that they did just for
Greg? Do you want to take that?
Yeah, and you know, you have every right to be confused because Warner Brothers bought them and they clustered them all together.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly
very hard. Yeah, and then they put them on channels and it's yeah. It's Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw McGraw, The Flintstones, The Jetsons, Johnny Quest, Scooby-Doo, The Funky Phantom, Goober and the Ghost Chasers, Jabberjaw, Laugh Olympics, Partridge Family 22,000 AD. Mm-hmm. There's just tons and tons of them.
There's Top tons, Cat. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, there are thousands.
namely the ones Smurfs. That I've definitely seen episodes of. Yeah, I've definitely seen episodes of the Smurfs in the morning on Cartoon Network. Definitely seen Yogi Bear. And then also one more, Scooby-Doo, obviously. So like growing up, watching these cartoons, I I appreciated them for what they were, and I never looked at like the animation quality, for instance, like, you know, as time goes on, when I'm watching them, it's what, the early 2000s. So there are better animated series out there, but not better in terms of the actual quality. Older TV, I have found, has more narrative structure, better episode, like episodic structure. I felt like they put more time, and I think you can definitely see that with the cartoons from Hanna-Barbera.
Gee, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
You know, Greg, I imagine you went a lot into how they changed the actual business itself.
Well, yeah, and also while I go through the move from MGM, which started the studio, and then the fact that they really weren't an independent company for very long. That's part of why Hanna-Barbera is and was what it was. Bill and Joe were guys that worked for people, and they ran a studio committed to staying open and making cartoons because that's what they loved to do. And after 10 years, they were bought by Taft Broadcasting. Taft wasn't a real bad company for them. And Taft started the theme parks, and that's where the Bradys and the Partridges went. But Hanna-Barbera was not Disney. They made cartoons and then live action, and they were going to grow and diversify, but it was about keeping that studio running. One of the things that Tom Sito told me was that there was about, I don't know, 1,500 people working or 1,400 people working in like 1978. And there was about 175 working at Disney. Mark Evanier did an interview, and I'm using this as well, where he asked Bill Hanna, this is an extraordinary thing. Maybe you should like turn down an assignment and maybe spend more time on something. And he said, okay, Mark, look down that hallway and you tell me who to fire. Bill was about, he reminds me of the crusty guy who gets off of the railroad car or the big chugging printing press and is wiping his greasy hands and saying, okay, what are we putting on next? But he'd throw himself on the tracks for any of his people. And Joe Barbera is the guy who's out there hustling. You know, he walked out of one meeting, apparently, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, walked out of one meeting, forgot what he sold. he was so good. So that's what they did.
They complemented each other so well. And the picture behind you is a great example of what you were talking about. Those are the employees. It was some kind of employee day, and they got everybody outside and took a picture, you know, celebrating whatever, right?
There was a lot of change in the 90s, you know, because it went from Taft was bought by Great America, or Ted Turner bought the library, and then Turner sold it to Warner. So in the space of a few years, they were owned by various companies. And the other thing to consider too is they were never completely autonomous.
And because you mentioned the sound effects and the sound effects library or something, if you have any exposure to Hanna-Barbera, right? And this would be different than a Looney Tunes cartoon, that the Hanna-Barbera sounds were kind of a syntax, I guess. Like you knew that the Fred Flintstone feet, like you knew what that was. That doesn't sound like people running quickly in real life. Kelsey, did you ever have any like Scooby-Doo toys or anything?
Scooby-Doo was a big one. I think we bought even like the Hot Wheels Scooby-Doo set. That was a whole thing.
That's great.
So, and like growing up, we used to have, I think we had Flintstones mugs. Did McDonald's do a run of mugs themed after like cartoons? That was it McDonald's? My dad used to collect those. I would have mugs and whatnot from all of these cartoons. My entire childhood, my dad owns a comic book store, by the way. I say it in pretty much every episode to every new guest. So yeah, growing up, I was watching all sorts of weird stuff that he would just put on for us, including all of these old cartoons. And it was, you know, growing up, he would vet it for quality, right? And whatever he loved growing up, that's what we would see. What I want to jump into in terms of the book and talking about the book, I want to know what sources then you interacted with to get all of this information. And then I guess like a little tease for why I should read it. Maybe one of like your favorite facts you learned in the process.
I have a feature on Jerry Beck's cartoon research blog called Animation Spin. I didn't review that many of the records because there's well over 200. So the question began, how do you organize them? Do we do this chronologically? How do you weave them? The big dilemma became, how do you keep people from saying, why are there records in this? Who cares? Because many of the people I contacted had never listened to these records. Mm. Most of the people who made them are gone. The artists who did the covers, a few of those are here, but they didn't listen to them. That's why some of the covers don't match. That's why Snagglepuss is like the Cowardly Lion on the cover of The Wizard of Oz, but he's not playing it on the record. They didn't hear the records.
Right.
Here's the title, do a cover. I contacted Dr. Demento. He said, I have to admit, I don't know the Hanna-Barbera stuff. And I'm like, you know everything. You're omnipotent. And no, he didn't know. And so I found a few people who did have some comments and very good ones about specific. Tim Hollis had some about the Golden Records. And I used those. But mostly it came from to everything I have been watching and listening to as many episodes. I mean, 425 Smurfs twice.
That's a lot.
it's not torture. Some people are saying, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, no, I think it's a great show. And I think it's very rich in really terrific scoring and an all-star cast of great actors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked the Smurfs. I appreciate it more now than then because that launched a genre that Disney did after Hanna-Barbera, because the Smurfs opened the door for storybook, gentle storybook fairy tale little characters on Saturday morning, which was revolutionary then. I mean, it changed TV, and that cartoon on television established them worldwide and made them a phenomenon.
That it's very interesting because you're telling the story of Hanna-Barbera through the lens of their records and music releases. It's a little windier because it wasn't their primary business, but it was a big business and they sold records, right?
And it was like Disney. It was a much more significant part of their business than anyone would have imagined. And it had an impact on the entertainment business more than anyone would have imagined, especially their own label. And the rock and roll that was on the Flintstones, Danny Hutton appeared on the Flintstones, on the Pebbles and Bam Bam episode, on the screen. You know, so, and so did one of the singles that they were trying to promote, Dance in the Sand, was their very first release single. So then there's this whole business that actually Cliff Nesteroff, who writes a lot about pop culture, he used his two essays because he had written a lot about the pop stuff. And that's a whole other extraordinarily bizarre story where they were getting in. They made about 75 pop singles. You know, the Avengers theme, Laurie Johnson's Avengers theme, the first time it appeared in America, see, it was on Pi Records in England, but the first time it was imported to America was on the Hanna-Barbera label. On a single and on an album. So that kind of stuff, you know, it was part of their company.
I had a meeting once at Adult Swim. They told me that quite a few of their programs didn't really make that much money on the air, but their recordings were making money. They're touring and you know, live shows, that model still works with animation.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They had the musical barbecue and the surf and turf. And there's also a promo album with about 90 drop-ins that that the Space Ghost did for radio stations, you know, thoughts for the day and stuff.
That's
funny. And then the Brack album from the Brack special for the direct video, Witch's Ghost. And my favorite, Alien Invaders, is a great album.
Yeah, like we actually used to listen to those in the car. Like, my dad's.
It's a great one.
Driving music.
And then the romantic one where Shaggy sings about the moon. I mean, that's hysterical. Mm-hmm. It's a great album. You know, so Ryan, and then when Rhino started in the 90s, and Earl Kress, who was really sort of a part of the soul of this book too, because he reinstituted the recordings in the 90s. He unearthed a lot of these soundtrack themes and background scores. And Rhino was very receptive to that. So they put out the Picnic Basket set with all the discs in it, and all of this great background music came out. So it was, it was gold. If interest was developed from this project, that vinyl aimed at adults, because this stuff is, the stuff from the 60s is not for children anymore, because the jokes are about LBJ and the atomic bomb, and you
still
know,
important.
Some of them could be reissued on vinyl in maybe a set or something, and the art is gorgeous, and now there is the way of reproducing the art.
Matt and I have one friend at Water Tower Music, and
still there?
And he's still there, and we're more than happy to put you in touch with him.
Yeah.
I don't know if he can help, but he's a good guy, and he certainly is a fan. So.
They have done some very interesting stuff, you know, and Dan and I were more than happy to take complimentary copies of what they did.
Oh, the Wizard of Oz was gorgeous, and the Grinch was very nice. You know,
and you know, our old boss George worked very closely, because George is totally, as you know, music score guy, and he knows it inside and out. And he was always working hand in hand with those guys, because you know the actual scores, the actual tracks, all that stuff lives in a vault in his mind and is scattered across a giant corporate library. So it's really, his mind is the index.
Because I believe it was like 1990 when the Carl Stalling Project CD came out.
That sounds about right. Yeah, it was 1991. Yeah.
And that, to me, because Kelsey, that's the, you know, the music of Looney Tunes, and it's so distinctive, but they did a great job of marketing that. You know, I was in college radio at the time, and we would play that, and it had never been presented to me separately from
it was really genius, and it was like this obvious thing that had been sitting in front of everyone and no one had done it, and as soon as it was done, everyone went, oh, wait a minute. And then you realize, oh, they just hadn't done it with Carl Stalling. There's this other legacy that you've been ignoring. Yeah.
And it was very adult. It was not a children's thing.
It was not for kids. And I had never encountered anything like it. But that was one that wound up on like the playlist. And it came with a little booklet like inside. It was so good. And I had always collected sound effect records, because they were weird, and the great thing about working at the college radio station is we had a studio where I could put actually two records on at once, hit record and talk over them. It was like I'd never worked with such, and it was professional equipment.
Yeah, but
it
two track.
So much fun. Yeah, I could have music and sound effects. As Dan knows, as digital video came in and they started, I think they released like the Hanna-Barbera sound effect collection.
Yeah.
It's still a sought after, I think, a collectible CD, but you know, it was hundreds and hundreds of sounds.
There's a whole other podcast we can just do about Hanna-Barbera's keyboard sound clip device.
that they used
the instrument.
Yes, that they used in the 60s and the 70s. That I don't think people are aware of the keyboard sound clip thing that existed in television, particularly Hanna-Barbera's, but it's also laugh tracks and everything else.
Charlie Douglas?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it like a cart machine? It played like tape loops? Like what?
Yeah, yeah. It were tape loops triggered by keystrokes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Howard Stern had like an early version of that.
And Hanna-Barbera had a bank of
Wow.
Yeah, and they would
play that live.
Must have had one of these CDs because I remember he worked for a radio station for a little bit, and he would clip those things. He would make our own CDs. He would burn them for us.
Yeah,
and he would. I remember distinctly Yogi Bear opening songs.
Oh.
Like he would just put some Yogi Bear clips in front of each next track.
That's the sound of love.
Yeah, exactly. it makes me very fond for those characters as well.
Really interested in the generational aspect of the Hanna-Barbera legacy. When people think of Looney Tunes, there's a very specific thing that is really locked in their heads. And it doesn't include most of the 60s Looney Tunes output. Hanna-Barbera, on the other hand, of the MGM era is like high quality gloss animation, right? And then you have the Hanna-Barbera of the 50s, which is sort of like developmental, like we're switching this up for TV. And then you have the explosion of the 60s with both the prime time and the Saturday morning. And I still remember everyone talks about the and Greg will know, when the Flintstones was referred to as a pen and ink disaster.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it was Variety. It may have been Hollywood Reporter, but I think it was Variety. Barbera never got over that.
Yeah, and then like in retrospect, I don't know, like when Matt and I saw the initial masters for the scans of the Jetsons, it was just like, This was not a disaster at all. The limited animation stuff, especially stuff they did for prime time, but even the Saturday morning stuff. Yeah, Johnny Quest and the Jetsons looked fantastic. But you know what looked really good? Herculoids. Really good.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I was blown away by the Blu-ray of that.
Yeah.
And what you also get with the Blu-rays is you are. Oh, blown away by no matter how fluid the animation is or not, you've got color stylists who know color and know how, and background artists who are artists, and just stand there and just look, just stare at the screen, and when it's on Blu-ray, it is dazzling to look at. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And then the 80s, there's sort of this resurgence, as we know, like the superstar movies and their syndication stuff. And then Cartoon Network in the 90s is a whole new era. And like Hanna-Barbera as a production facility reinvents itself only to then be kneecapped. Hanna-Barbera as a brand, because of the legacy of the work of the people who worked on it, is probably strongest animation brand names still, to the point where, you know, there's initiative going on in the UK and they're openly trying to exploit it. I don't know how successful it is. This is me being old fan, so ignore that. But I'm just saying, it is fascinating when people think animation. I think you think Disney, and I think you think Hanna-Barbera.
Talking to Kelsey earlier, she did not have that distinction because she fell in that post, you know, like Cartoon Network, where they kind of blended it all together. And off the top of her head, it's like there's the Turner, you know, because Dan and I see it as, well, there's the Turner Cartoon Network output. There's the, you know, legacy Looney Tunes output, the Hanna-Barbera output, and then the WB animation output. Like, we see it as kind of four competing sort of styles and how they blend. And Dan and I, especially, you know, going from at least the early 90s on, you can see the people generally would work together in sort of one of those tracks. And fans learned to sort of follow those tracks, like the Timverse, you know, like Bruce Timm's vision of Batman and Batman the Animated Series is pretty easy to track, and its influence. Classic Looney Tunes, you know, it was reinvented in the 90s a little bit with the Animaniacs, which, you know, are being brought back, right? Like, Kelsey, you know what the Animaniacs are? That might have fallen into your...
I don't remember if I've seen Animaniacs.
Yeah, that's okay.
Pinky and the Brain?
I've seen Pinky and the Brain.
So it's like, when were you young and what were you exposed to, and how much further did you go into the weeds, you know?
Like, yeah, I definitely didn't go into the weeds, because when I was watching this, I probably could barely read. I was shown these when I was really young. I'm thinking, like, Scooby-Doo is really interesting because it does, the animation does also change over time, and the different reboots. And, like, what's also interesting is the theme song. Listening to the different versions of the theme song, mm-hmm. the, like, first one is way slower than the newer versions. And the animation style is also really interesting. So I see what you're saying in terms of, like, reboots and keeping these characters alive. I think with Scooby-Doo, they managed to do it really well. Some of the other characters, not as well.
You know, the Johnny Quest, Tom and Jerry crossover is an interesting example of how you can successfully take two historic brands.
But honestly, this is how fans who are animators behind the scenes are able to sneak one through, because they were able to justify it because it was Tom and Jerry. I haven't seen Spy Quest.
Yes, it is.
You should see it. It's beautifully it is true. Done. It's true to Johnny, and it's true to Tom and Jerry, and it's really good.
And style-wise, they just got... I mean, it's astonishing. Artistically, they worked really hard on matching the styles and then making them fit together. One of the things I noticed about, because I looked at all the Tom and Jerry's and then the 92 movie. And here's a little factoid that a lot of people were surprised by, but I lived through it. Because when I was working at Disney, the movie had come out and Disney was just about to buy Miramax. And so Disney had, and I have a photograph of them, Disney had Tom and Jerry at their park at the Disney MGM Studios in Florida. And Disney made a commercial promoting Tom and Jerry at their park. And they showed the costume characters running around, not Universal, but running around the Disney MGM Studios chasing each other. I mean, that is, and plus I always love to bring guests through and say, come over here to the plaque with William Hanna and Joseph Barbera's names on it here at this Disney park, because they're part of the Academy honorees. But what was interesting was that movie had its problems, but they solved them, because the reason those Tom and Jerry films work, for those who say, why in the world would it work when you put them with this character, or when you stick them on this book or add them to this story? Because they're like the second couple in a Broadway musical, you know, like Gower Champion and, you know, they're the second couple, or they're like Abbott and Costello. They're the drama's going on, and they're us, or they're the conduit between us. And once they discovered Tom and Jerry would work that way, they could put them in anything.
Right.
And for some bizarre reason, those things work. They shouldn't, but they do.
That's like the magic of the comedy duo, right? You know, Abbott Costello can go anywhere.
Yeah.
or not to Mars.
Well,
when should people look for this book?
We're looking at either Christmas 2023 or spring 24. And I'm very lucky, I got to say, and it's really Tim Hollis who brought me into that fold, that I got a publisher like this, because I want this to be a book everybody blesses and says that, you know, this is, because we have so much out there that isn't quite, I don't want it to be wrong. You know, I don't, and right. And it's very hard to make sure that, that when you make a declaration that this is the first one, it's like, it better be the first one, right, when you say things like that.
So. Do you already have the photos that are going to go in the book? I don't think it'll just be text. So visually, how does that process look?
We negotiated how many photos we were allowed to use. And then it's also a matter of digging out personal photos, contacting people saying, can we use this? Can we use that? Getting photos of, you know, like Herb Duncan, who was the golden George Jetson and stuff like that. And then photographing album covers. I don't know that I'm going to photograph all of them, because I don't know how many will be allowed to use. These colors, these album covers, especially the ones they did themselves, you know, because it was an in-house record company, those were hand-painted covers with hand-painted lettering, and they were gorgeous. And if we could actually get the source art, that would be even better, but they can still make them look really nice. I think fair use comes into play too. Depending on what legal says, we're speaking about this album, we want to show the cover. Is that fair use? It depends on what their legal says. We don't have that many pages either. Do you guys remember the blue, the beautiful blue label that HBR had with the sound waves? Oh, I'd love to have that somehow. In fact, Water Tower released one reissue from the original albums, Pebbles and Bam Bam Christmas. And they had a whole thing in the J card of the blue HBR with those squiggly waves. It's a gorgeous label, and I'd love to be able to incorporate that in.
But the magic of rights and clearances, which is, you know, I've done a book, and that takes almost as much time as it does to write it.
Which means, you know, that's why I don't want to promise it too soon.
That's a good point. Dan, do you have any final questions?
About music clearances?
No, just because we got to wrap it up. That was me cueing you to be like, do you have anything else? Because we have a question from our listeners.
Before we get to listener questions, I'm going to do a personal plug. After the article on the Slinky, on page 49, there is an article on search. If you read this article, you might see my name.
That is... Oh, Dan, what is search? Why don't you tell people?
Search is the greatest spy-fi show you've never watched. It was a wheel show in which agents used high-tech devices to be in touch with a mission control operation that helped them with their spy missions. It starred Hugh O'Brien, Tony Franciosa, Doug McClure, and most importantly, Burgess Meredith, who played the head of mission control. It lasted less than one season, and I love it very much.
I thought of it as like the early 70s version of 24.
Howard Gordon has honestly talked about how much Search was an influence on 24.
It's like Inside Out.
It's Inside Out plus 24.
That's cool.
Wasn't that a Leslie Stevens show?
It was. It was Leslie Stevens, yeah.
From the Outer Limits.
Hot off of Outer Limits, teamed up with Bob Justman, hot off of season 3 of Star Trek.
By the way, Kelsey, don't feel bad if you haven't heard of it, because that is quite an obscurity.
Search?
But, yeah.
Yeah.
1973. Is that correct?
73. I don't think they clipped it in American TV history.
I had never seen it. And Dan could not stop talking about it. And the day that word came that Search would be unearthed, Dan said it was huge news on his Yahoo list server, which in the 2010s he was still part of. Like, that's how long fans were
waiting. That Yahoo group comes up in the article, so everyone should read it.
All right, well, speaking of groups, I informed our masses of social media followers that we would be talking about Hanna-Barbera and its legacy. And I got a few questions. This comes from Sarah from Twitter. Are Barbera properties in Pasadena owned by the same people behind the animation?
Someone tell me about Barbera properties in Pasadena, because I don't know what that is.
I don't either.
Well, let me tell you.
Two of us. Okay.
They are a rental company of apartments based in the San Gabriel Valley that was founded in 1956.
So they rent apartments?
It's like you go to their Barbera Properties website, and they own and rent properties, and they do it in the San Gabriel Valley. I think they have some apartments in Phoenix. It's a real estate thing.
It's somebody's side business.
So wait, did we find out that the answer is yes or no?
Ah, good question. Because I was like, 56. It sounds like a Joe Barbera relative,
right?
But I couldn't make that. They did not reference it on their website. So, but I was like, at first I was like, that's a ridiculous question. And then I was like, well, maybe. I thought it was a snarky comment. And then I was like, huh. And then I, of course, did find a Cartoon Brew article from 2011.
God bless Cartoon Brew.
That reported that Joe Barbera's widow sold their Studio City estate for $7 million. Studio City is not quite in the San Gabriel Valley. But then they made a comment that was, quote, "It's not the real site of any real animation history unless you're an admirer of a pup named Scooby-Doo and Jetsons the movie."
And who isn't?
There was.
We love you, Tiffany, as Judy.
There was a comment that, from a fan of 1991's Yo Yogi, who countered that the house should actually be
the Yo Yogi house.
Yeah, the Yo Yogi house, and deserved a plaque.
That was it
for questions, and we answered it because I said we'd answer any question. Dan, we do accept review copies, and specifically they are to be addressed to you. Is that true still? Has anybody ever sent you anything?
Not yet.
Oh, there you go.
As I've made clear, help you engage with your fan base.
Yes. So you can contact Dan on Twitter at Dwiff.
DWIFF, right? Not to be confused with the Detroit Windsor International Film Festival.
Slide into Dan's DMs and send him review copies.
Look, like life, Cthulhu ends with death or madness.
And so does this podcast.
There we go.
I'm Matt Patterson. These are my co-hosts.
Kelsey Milburn.
Yeah, Kasagawa.
And our special guest, Greg.
Airbar.
Airbar.
Greg Airbar.
Thanks for everybody for bearing with us. And I hope you learned something today about Hanna-Barbera and their musical legacy.
Woo.
Bye.